when you hear a show tune from the Great White Way, does a shiver run through ya? Well, we're giving them to ya. Sing hallelujah and shout hooray. Come on along and listen to Broadway to Main Street. USA.
I grow too old to dream, I'll have you to remember. When I grow too old to dream, your love will live in my heart. So kiss me, my sweet, and so let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, your love will live in my heart.
Too old to dream about the marvelous, miraculous lyrics of Oscar Hammerstein. Hello, this is Larry Maslon, your host for Broadway to Main Street, here on 88.3 FM WLIW, Long Island's only NPR station, emanating out of Southampton, Long Island, westward towards New York City and northward towards Southern Connecticut, bringing you yet another hour of fascinating program about that great art form, the American musical theater. Well, what better person to lead us into a second hour about the American musical theater, second parter, than Oscar Hammerstein II. We heard his song, When I Grow Too Old to Dream, music by Sigmund Romberg, and sung, of course, by Nat King Cole. And this is a second episode based on a book that has just come out called The Letters of Oscar Hammerstein II, and it is edited by Mark Eden Horowitz, the senior music specialist at the Library of Congress, a longtime friend, a great colleague, and it's quite a remarkable book. It's over 1,000 pages, but it has over 1,000 letters by and from and to Oscar Hammerstein over the course of 4 decades. So it tells you everything you could possibly want to know about this fascinating individual. Even if you thought you knew everything the way smarty pants like I do, you'll find many, 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 many surprises. So we're going to pick up on the second hour. Our first hour dealt with a lot with Jerome Kern and his shows, Hammerstein shows of the 20s and 30s, and some of his pop hits and some of his very tolerant political views. But let us go into the world of the mid to late 40s, 50s, into 1960. Richard Rodgers we'll talk about, Stephen Sondheim we'll talk about. We'll talk about some projects that Oscar dreamt of, which didn't happen. And I want to add that Oscar Hammerstein is very much in the zeitgeist because there is a new organization called the Oscar Hammerstein Museum and Theater Education Center in Bucks County, where he had his home and farm for many years. And on July 11th, they're doing a fantastic gala called The Sound of Hammerstein to sort of launch this project. So we want to support them. So check them out at hammersteinmuseum.org. But while you're thinking of doing that, we will turn our conversation back to the man himself and his marvelous lyrics with Mark Eden Horowitz. And it's a fantastic book. And there's another character who makes a sort of cameo appearance. One almost wishes that he had a few more of his missives, but maybe that's your next book, Mark. And that's Stephen Sondheim.
And I've heard of him.
Yes, indeed. You wrote a wonderful book about him called Sondheim on Music. And this is one of these like things you couldn't make up if you tried, right? So this is like saying Picasso grew up next door to Monet, or Elvis Presley grew up in Bing Crosby's backyard. The fact that Hammerstein is clearly the giant of the musical theater for the first half of the 20th century, and Sondheim is a giant for the second half. And their paths crossed on a personal level at such an early stage of Sondheim's development. Now that the other great man has left us, do you have any thoughts about that as you worked on the book?
Well, it's as I was working on the project, I would email letters to Steve that I thought he'd find interesting. And if you recall, there's one letter where to Josh Logan about what's currently playing on Broadway and what he should see and should not see and Oscar's opinions of them. And one show he talks about is West Side Story, which mm-hmm. he recommends. And I sent that letter to Steve, who was actually rather upset that he didn't mention him.
And yeah, that's interesting.
And Gypsy, said, too. You know, Logan knew me, and he was taken aback that Oscar didn't say anything about Steve's involvement in the show. And I sort of regretted sending him the letter because I felt like I hurt him by doing that.
Well, the same thing is true with Gypsy, which is somewhat surprising. He mentions that a couple times, and he doesn't mention Steve.
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe he thought he was gilding the lily or being too, he wanted to not put his thumb on the scale, as it were. Who knows?
And the one time he does mention Steve, not by name, is somebody, he sends a thank you note to somebody who sent him a chess set. Uh-huh. And he talks about how he was taught chess by a young 13-year-old genius who's clearly, we know, Sondheim.
Right. How fascinating. So we're going to hear Gertrude Lawrence, who appears a lot in the book as well, from The King and I, because there are a lot of letters around that time of the early 1950s. Perhaps you could set up the that inscription of Oscar's for Steve with the lyric from that show.
Oh, from getting to know you, from your children, from your students, you'll be taught.
Right.
Yeah, and that was just before Oscar passed away.
Yeah, and he inscribed that, yeah.
Yeah, and well, Yeah.
Well, let's hear from Gertrude Lawrence, who caused no end of difficulty, wonderful though she was, for both Dick and Oscar in The King and I.
It's a very ancient saying, but a true and honest thought, that if you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. As a teacher I've been learning, and forgive me if I boast, that I've now become an expert on the subject I like most. Getting to know you. Getting to know you. Getting to know all about you. Getting to like you. Getting to hope you like me. Getting to know you. Putting it my way, but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I'm with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed, suddenly I'm bright and breezy, because of all the beautiful and new about you day by
kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on. Moment live. Oh, give me what you alone can give. I kiss the pill I dream on.
That was Louis Armstrong singing A Kiss to Build a Dream On, another early Oscar Hammerstein song for Hollywood, I believe. Yes?
Yeah, for the Marx Brothers originally.
Right, right. It was supposed to go into A Night at the Opera.
Yep. Yeah.
And it was replaced by Alone, which made Kitty Carlisle's career. So there's a wonderful another through line in this book, which,
one of the great pleasures of this project to me was discovering various characters. And the funniest letters of all are by Harry Ruby, with whom he wrote A Kiss to Build a Dream On. Ruby is a delicious and delightful character.
And also Groucho Marx's best friend.
Exactly, exactly. And you can see why.
Yeah. And a big baseball fan, I think, I recall. Yeah. But one of the other through lines in your book is how Oscar also had a dual career as a theater man, but also he had tremendous royalties and placements in popular song with the songs he wrote. And I was wondering, we'll hear in a moment a performance by Dinah Shore that he writes about that he saw on television. But I'm wondering how you see him as a popular songwriter as opposed to a theatrical songwriter, and if there is anything in the book that points in one direction or another about that.
I mean, he was certainly thrilled when audiences were touched by songs. It's the truthfulness of the performer. What's interesting is there are letters to young singers and mostly potential theatrical performers. And he's always concerned with the truth of their performance and not the beauty of their voice or their instrument. And it's always... I think that's something Steve got from him too. Hmm. It's not about the instrument. It's about conveying the meaning behind the song as truthfully and honestly as possible. And I think that's what comes through, and that's what he responds to, whether it's in the theater or on a pop recording.
And he said something about Dinah Shore. This is 1956, so the song had been out for 5 years, and he said he had never heard it done quite as well, I believe, and took the initiative to write her. You can only imagine what life was like in the Shore household when that letter arrived unsolicited from Oscar.
Do you want me to read some
Please,
of the letter?
I would love it. Okay. So
dear
great.
Dinah, some time ago I wrote you a fan letter about the way you sang "Hello, Young Lovers." Since then, you have sung many of my songs, and I have quelled the impulse to write you by saying to myself, I cannot keep writing to her every time she sings the song well, because she always does. Now I am forced to break my silence because I sat dewy-eyed listening to you sing Something Wonderful last night, and I can't remember when I ever heard man, woman, or child sing a song with such compassionate understanding, grace, and empathy. And the letter goes on, but that's... Oh. Can you imagine getting a letter like that?
Well, through the magic of digital reconnaissance, let's hear Dinah Shore sing that song.
He will not always say what you would have him say, but now and then you'll say something wonderful. The thoughtless things he'll do will hurt and worry you, but now and then dreams that won't come true. You know that he believes in them, and that's enough for you. You'll always go along, defend him when he's wrong, and tell him when he's
I'm talking with Mark Horwitz. We're wrapping up. We could easily talk on and on and on. We could talk all night. I could have talked all night. That's another lyricist entirely. One of the things that knocked me out, I mean, your book is full of like great long letters, and then you'll come across what I call an aperçu, you know, just sort of some little throwaway remark or observation by Oscar. And he talks about Pipe Dream, which was their least successful show, Rodgers and Hammerstein's least successful show. And as they were writing it, as was the case, right, Hammerstein wrote the lyrics first and would send them or phone them into Dick Rodgers. And he's writing to someone, I forget who, but he says, yeah, I sent Dick a bunch of songs, lyrics, and I haven't heard the tunes yet because he's waiting to read two or three or four of them so he can see how they go together. And that to me was a thunderbolt, because that's the one thing I've always said about Rodgers, is he orchestrated the American musical better than anyone. And I don't mean the instruments. His way of going from trios to solos to fast to slow to polkas to blah, blah, blah. And you could see the architecture of his brain in that one sentence that Hammerstein wrote. There doesn't seem to be a lot of pain in their collaboration. There is a fair amount of discussion about shows that do well financially and don't do well financially. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how he saw their collaboration, or was he simply in the middle of it so much that they were just doing, even until the day he died practically, it seemed like they were moving on to the next project?
The surprising thing to me was how much of their letters are about the business of show business. There's not that much about the art of the show business. And there's only one set of letters where they're actually collaborating by mail, and that's when they're writing Cinderella. Mm. And it's great to see that exchange. And it's a little surprising because Roger sort of comments on a split infinitive of Oscar's, who comes to his own defense a bit. And I love the fact that even after all these years, Oscar asked Rodgers if it's sort of grammatically correct for a song to start in minor and end in major. And Rodgers writes back, not only is it appropriate, but it has a long history.
What was that?
Only the clock, up there in the tower, striking a 11:45.
I must go.
But you have just arrived. Or is it ages ago that you came?
It seems like a moment ago. And forever ago.
Are you really here with me in this garden? Or are you a figure of enchantment? Is this really happening? Or are we in a dream?
If it is enchantment, I hope it is forever. If it is a dream, I wish never to awaken.
If it is not enchantment or a dream, then why do I feel as I do? Do I love you because you're beautiful? Or are you beautiful because I love you? Am I making believe I see in you a girl too lovely to be really true? Do I want you because you're wonderful, or are you wonderful because I want you? Are you the sweet invention of a lover's dream? Or are you really as beautiful as you seem?
I cannot believe this is happening to me, that I am here with you, and that you love me. Am I making believe I see in you a man too perfect to be really true?
Met mine just as your boat sailed by. This I know of you, nothing more. You are the girl whose eyes met mine passing the fall of lotus leaves night. While your flower boat sailed away, gently your eyes looked back on mine. Clearly you heard me say,
were both extraordinary businessmen. And I think somehow people think of Rogers as more of the businessman than Oscar, but I've actually come to think it's almost more the other way around, that Oscar was more of the businessman than Rogers was.
He certainly wrote one of the greatest, although perhaps least well-known, songs about the theater business, from Me and Juliet show, which was not a huge success, although I think it's quite admirable. Here is Big Hayes singing about the theater as the big black giant.
The water in a river is changed every day as it flows from the hills to the sea. But to people on the shore, the river is the same, or at least it appears to be. The audience in a theater is changed every night as a show runs along on its way. But to people on the stage, the audience looks the same every night, every matinee. A big black giant who looks and listens with thousands of eyes and ears. A big black mass of love and pity and troubles and hopes and fears. And every night the mixture's different, although it may look the same. To feel his way with every mixture is part of the actor's game. One night it's a laughing giant, another night a weeping giant. One night it's a coughing giant, another night a sleeping giant. Every night you fight the giant, and maybe if you win, you send him out a nicer giant than he was when he came in. But if he doesn't like you, then all you can do is to pack up your makeup and go. For an actor in a flop, there isn't any choice but to look for another show. That big black giant who looks and listens with thousands of eyes and ears. That big black mass of love and pity and troubles and hopes and fears will sit out there and rule your life for all your living years.
From Me and Juliet, music by Richard Rodgers, lyrics of
course. That was a surprising choice.
By Oscar Hammerstein. Well, it's, if you look in my book on Broadway, the final picture of Oscar standing on 44th Street has that lyric next to it.
Wow.
Because I think it shows, you know, he was a very heartfelt person, clearly, and he appreciated the pain of failure as much as the joy of success. You know, he was not a cynical fellow. He was the opposite. So I'm finishing up, although again, this is, it seems all too brief to talk about this amazing, anthology of 1,000 letters by the real giant of the American musical theater, Oscar Hammerstein, here with its editor, Mark E. Horowitz.
They're not all letters by Oscar.
That's true. Both sides, by and so. Two. Absolutely. Yeah. Well put. Here's a question, which is more speculative than anything. It was almost impossible for me to read the book and not wonder what he would have thought about fill in the blank. What do you think in the years he passed away in the
spring? 1960.
When? In the middle of the year, I think?
I want to say April, May.
I think in the middle of 1960. And obviously we're you know, 62 years later. What are the kinds of shows that came after Oscar that you think he might have appreciated because they were in his mode or they were in his vision, as it were?
Fiddler.
Uh-huh. Tell me why.
Well, sir, we know it was a show that he himself was interested in, but there's something about Sheldon Harnick to me, in a way, is of all the other lyricists, the inheritor of Oscar's humanity, I guess, and warmth and a sort of a similar kind of sense of humor almost.
Goldie, I've decided to give Perchik permission to become engaged to our daughter Huddle.
What? He's poor. He has nothing. Absolutely nothing.
He's a good man, Goldie. I like him. And what's more important, Huddle likes him. Huddle loves him. So what can we do? It's a new world. A new world. Love. Goldie, do you love me?
Do I what?
Do you love me?
Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out. Go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion.
Goldie, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me?
You're a fool.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well?
For 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?
Goldie, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared.
I was shy.
I was nervous.
So was I.
But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. And now I'm asking, Goldie, do you love me?
I'm your wife.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love him?
Well?
For 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?
Then you love me.
I suppose I do.
And I suppose I love you too. It doesn't change a thing. But even so, after 25 years, it's nice to know.
You had mentioned that, which I think is very, very astute, that Sheldon Harnick is probably more so than Steve Sondheim, the inheritor of Oscar's ethos. And when I think of Sheldon's shows, I think of Fiddler, not just as a play about Jewishness and tradition, but about family, generation gaps, and passing a legacy down. And then I think of The Rothschilds, which is also about that. And Rex, his very unsuccessful show with Richard Rodgers, which the strong points are about that as well. So I think that's fascinating. There is a show which you hint at, which is a 21st century musical in one of your notes that does also have a lineage to Richard Rodgers that he had considered briefly.
Would that be White in the Piazza?
It sure would. Talk about his reaction to that.
Well, that was a letter that absolutely shocked me. I had no expectation of coming upon it. A few months before Oscar died, he got a letter from a complete stranger suggesting that this story that I think appeared in the New Yorker called Light in the Piazza would make a great source for a musical. And Oscar writes back very positively about the story itself. He doesn't feel prepared to pursue it at that point. And we know in retrospect that he was very ill at that point and didn't have that much longer to live. But he seems taken with the idea and certainly is not dismissive of it at all.
What I seem to remember, he also implies that it's an exciting idea to him and he has to figure out a way how to crack it. Like what's his way in that? So you sort of hear a little crackle of electricity when I read that letter. It's like you can feel his brain kind of saying, oh, okay, that could be the next thing. We're into the 60s now.
It's rushing up, it's pouring out, it's
Well, sadly, Oscar Hammerstein passed away in August of 1960 on the heels of the tremendous success of Sound of Music. I did feel towards the end, maybe the when he got sick with stomach cancer and even the months before that, he's a little looser in his last 50 letters you have in the book. He's a little less concerned about propriety. He sort of seems to speak his mind a little bit more. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading into that. Did you feel that?
I didn't. I was impressed. There was sort of a philosophical kindness, I thought, in his later letters. You know, there's a couple of throughout his career, he helps other people and reads their works and gives them opinion and guidance. And I think it's Skouros, I may be wrong about that, who's clearly sent him a screenplay to review. And there are two extraordinarily long, detailed letters where he's just painstakingly giving so much of himself to this guy for a project that he has absolutely no involvement in.
And no interest in. It's like a Roman emperor yeah. kind of movie. Yeah.
Yeah. But I found very touching. And, you know, it's not entirely clear if he knew how sick he was, but there is an undercurrent that he sees things winding down. And there is no project on, you know, that he's looking ahead towards the last several months of his life, which is unusual.
But there is a tantalizing thing, which again shows you how forward-thinking he was in the form, is his notion of tackling Allegro as a television show.
Yeah.
As adapting it for television. And you go, oh, of course, there's another broad canvas for him to conquer. He and Dick had already conquered Cinderella. But this almost feels like a movie, like it would have done very well in the 70s or 80s or 90s. So fascinating. So we are concluding, although I don't really want to go, Mark, with Mark Eden Horowitz and his book, The Letters of Oscar Hammerstein, which, as he reminded me, is at least 1,000 letters, many of them from Oscar Hammerstein, but many of them to Oscar Hammerstein by fascinating people, Dick Rogers, Jerome Kern, Edna Ferber, a wonderful writer named High Craft, Josh Logan, all sorts of celebrities. Irene Dunn sends a lovely letter. That's who we started with. What do you want us to take away from this book, and how does it, do you think it's going to make people rethink Oscar Hammerstein, or have we already thought a lot about Oscar Hammerstein?
I thought much differently about him through this process, and I fell head over heels in love with Oscar through this project. And you know, I desperately want other people to feel about him the way I grew to feel about him. And I think that they will. And his humor, his warmth, his kindness, his thoughtfulness, his work ethic, his everything about him just sort of shines for me. And I now feel this great responsibility towards his legacy. And as I mentioned before, I think I feel improved by my exposure to him as a human being. And I hope other people are too.
Well, Mark, thanks to your work, his reputation, his legacy will only bloom and grow. And let us close out with the last song he ever wrote for The Sound of Music, sung by a singer I think he would have loved, Audra McDonald. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Well, where is the time all gone to? This is Larry Maslon here at Broadway to Main Street. Let's catch up next Sunday at 3.
There's so much more embracing still to be done, but time is racing. Oh, well, we'll catch up some other time.